Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN Office of Geneva for this press briefing hosted by the UN Information Service at Geneva. We have a very busy agenda, very important agenda, as always, here in Geneva. We have Sudan. We have a situation in the West Bank. We have the situation in Ukraine. And we also have an update from colleagues from UNDP on Melissa, Hurricane Melissa. We also have an announcement from our friends at the ECE. So let's start off right away. I'm going to throw to our colleague who's joining us from Port Sudan, from UNMASS, the UN Mine Action Service, Mohamed Sadiq Rashid. And I'm very grateful to you, sir, for joining us. So over to you for an update on specifically on the explosive remnants of war in the country. So over to you.
Thank you very much. And a very good morning, good afternoon, distinguished journalists, colleagues, and friends. I would like to draw your attention to one of the critical and often overlooked protection dimension. And that is the actually even perceived presence of explosive hazards. In Sudan, this is becoming a major issue for civilians, particularly for those who are displaced and those who are returning to their homes. Sudan has experienced armed conflicts since 1955. Each of these wars, including the current one that is taking place largely in urban areas, has left behind explosive hazards. Explosive ordnance, abandoned ammunition, anti-personnel mines, anti-vehicle landmines, and this is a reality that we must confront. Allow me to address one of the questions. Why UXO is left behind? Just a few words on this. Unexploded and abandoned explosive ordnance remain on battlefields for several reasons. First of all, weapons often fail to detonate as intended. Many munitions malfunction because of manufacturing defects, aging, and poor storage, impact with soft ground, or damage from the heat, humidity, corrosion. As a result, bombs, shells, mortars, submunitions remain on the ground as deadly hazards. So second, the use of indiscriminate weapons, which is sadly the case in Sudan, artillery, rockets. With this conflict so far, we haven't heard about cluster munitions, but previous conflicts, the cluster munitions have been used. Air-delivered bombs are being used, and these are spreading explosives over wider areas. Many of these fail to detonate and create the contamination across entire neighborhoods and farmlands. Third, very important point that armed groups often lack records or oversight. They do not track firing positions. They do not record ammunition usage. This is creating a lot of challenges for the mine action sectors to quickly address the problem. And then this new contamination in Sudan due to the ongoing war, this is coming on top of the 34 square kilometers of legacy explosive ordnance which remained from the earlier conflicts. Sudan now faces an extremely complex contamination landscape, unexploded and abandoned ammunition, anti-vehicle mines, and more recently confirmed anti-personnel mines within Khartoum itself. These hazards affect both urban centers, mainly urban centers, such as Khartoum and Al-Fashir and many other towns, and also rural areas. Many households are returning to states like Khartoum, Jazeera, and Sennar due to improved security, but they are returning to areas where explosive ordnance remains a daily threat. Displaced families often settle in unfamiliar locations without any awareness of past conflicts or contamination. And I would like to highlight that children are especially vulnerable. As more people return to the contaminated areas, civilian casualties continue to rise. Explosive incidents cause devastating injuries, including amputations and lifelong disabilities. And we know that the cases that are being reported represent only a fraction of the true scale of the harm. So let me talk a little bit about the impact on services, aid delivery, and recovery operations. Explosive contamination around critical infrastructure prevents access to essential services, livelihoods, and markets. It also poses major challenges for humanitarian recovery operations. Without clearance, humanitarian access will remain constrained. Staff are exposed to unacceptable risks, and munitions in need and communities in need may remain cut off from assistance. So I would like to conclude with the way forward. What needs to be done? So Sudan now faces an urgent need to scale up mine action. The large-scale survey and clearance operations are required to identify, mark, and remove explosive hazards that endanger civilians and restrict humanitarian space. We need age and gender responsive risk education to ensure that communities, including children and humanitarian workers, know how to recognize, avoid, and report explosive hazards. I would like to highlight that now the contamination is in urban areas. And the previous mine action services did not target people living in urban areas. So many of the people living in urban areas remain unaware of the risks. And we also, I would like to also highlight that victim assistance must also be strengthened. We need to provide survivors with medical care and other supports so that they could rebuild their lives with dignity. So only through these integrated mine action efforts, clearance, risk education, and victim assistance, Sudan can reduce the immediate threat to life, enable safe and dignified return, and support the broader humanitarian recovery and reconstruction efforts across the country. Just to finalize my statement on what resources are available currently. Ladies and gentlemen, looking at the scale of the problem, the available resources are very few, very few. As I speak now, we have only five survey and clearance teams, which are made up of five operators, only four operators in each team. And increasingly, every day, we are getting more and more requests. There are minefields, there are people living and walking in the contaminated areas. The aid workers are returning. You know, we receive requests for clearing offices. So we are quite overwhelmed. And most of the resources are in Khartoum because majority of contamination is there, but also, there are many areas that people have returned, but there are no mine action services. That is a sad reality I wanted to conclude. But I also wanted to say that, this problem can be addressed. There is expertise, there are knowledge, there are experience, and the basic infrastructure exists, and we can address this problem. So with this, I would like to conclude. Back to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rashid. And I should note that Mr. Rashid was kind enough to share with us fact sheets, which we are, if we haven't already, we'll soon share these fact sheets with you, which complement this very, very important briefing. So thank you. So we're going to stay on Sudan, colleagues. I'm going to throw it to Eugene from UNHCR, who is going to introduce her guest, Jacqueline Parlavillette, who you know, who will talk about the displaced civilians in the country. Over to you, Eugene.
Thank you very much. As you remember, Jacqueline briefed you 2 weeks ago after the fall of Erfasher. And then now that she's joining from Port Sudan to explain the current situation as the Sudan continue to stay as the world's largest displacement crisis with the 12 million people displaced inside and then outside of Sudan. So over to you, Jacqueline.
Thank you very much, Eugene, and also thank you, colleagues, for the opportunity to brief you for the second time on the situation in Sudan. I will start with my focus on Darfur, As you know, we continue to see people who escape under extremely difficult conditions, al-Fashr, and by the time they reach Tawila, they account many, many of the atrocities that they have not only faced in al-Fashr before they left, but also during their flight. We see, we hear more and more people that are stranded on different in different villages along the dangerous route from al-Fashr to Tawila. And we hear that very frequently. As people are stranded, they are robbed of their belongings, gender-based violence is reported, child separation is reported, arrest and detention, but also killing, in particularly for those who cannot afford to pay the amount of money which is necessary to take them to the next station, or alternatively, you know, to pay ransom in order to be released. These situations that people are describing, they remind me very much of, you know, the stories that we also hear when people are being smuggled or trafficked across the territory. Here, they are, you know, facing these extreme challenges when they pass a stretch of about 50-kilometer road from al-Fashr to Tawila. Unfortunately, due to the very violence and the insecure roads, it is very difficult for humanitarian actors that are based in Tawila to reach out and to provide support, humanitarian aid, and of course also healthcare amongst the people that are en route. It's very recent that humanitarian agencies have been able to reach a place called Korma, and we sincerely hope that, you know, with the visit of the emergency relief coordinator, including to that area, that, you know, it triggers further opening up access to people that are very vulnerable people, excuse me, that are being stranded along the route. What we hear from people along the route, in addition to the extreme violations they report, is obviously as well, you know, the need for urgent humanitarian aid. Again, we hear a lot of unaccompanied and separated children that have arrived to Tawila. Care arrangements are being looked into together with UNICEF. We also unfortunately keep on hearing about many cases of gender-based violence. And although, you know, we have provided some support to the Ministry of Health in Tawila and provided them with medical kits to treat the survivors of GBV, this is by no means enough to respond to the scale of the crisis. Now, what we also see the last week is a sort of a new pattern, in the sense that people are not only moving to Tawila, which is, as I said, at 50-kilometer distance and a very insecure route, but people are also moving further afield. And for instance, for now, we have seen about 2,000 individuals arriving to a place called Adaba, which is in the northern state. Why are people going so far? One would wonder, but what we hear from the new arrivals there is that they really want to go as far away from Darfur as possible. They believe that moving in the direction of Khartoum or Port Sudan are the safer areas for them. And obviously some people also have family members in these locations and they try to join them. So everybody also, you know, is concerned about the access to the displaced in Darfur, and in particularly in Tawila, where the numbers are so high that in any case, not everybody currently benefits from one or the other support, provision of humanitarian aid or support. So UNHCR is again reinforcing its response in Tawila, and to the extent possible also in other areas, including in Adaba. We are sending currently rope hauls for communal shelter, or at least for initial reception of newly arrived IDPs as they wait for other supplies, other support, including tents, blankets, sleeping mats, cooking items, etc. You know, the winter is coming, and people really need to have urgent this support in order to safely rest in the areas where they are displaced now. So on that note, I would like to hand back to my colleague Eugene. Eugene, over to you.
Thank you very much, Jacqueline. I appreciate that very thoughtful brief. And colleagues, we'll take questions now. If you could kindly indicate who you're directing your query to. We'll start in the room. Yes, Efe.
Alicia Agar from the Spanish News Agency. I wanted to ask Mr. Rashid about some questions. I wanted to ask if there are weapons that are not allowed by the international humanitarian law that are being used in Sudan, and if maybe this is related to the explosive remnants. Also, is this the remnants, the explosive remnants, is it especially critical in Sudan compared to other conflicts? And how do they prevent people? And is there a way to prevent this during a war? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rashid. Did you get those questions?
Sure, thank you very much. Thank you for raising this question. Allow me to first address your question in relation to comparing the explosive hazard contamination in Sudan with some of the other areas, countries that are affected. There are many other countries. There are many other countries that are affected by explosive remnants of war in landmines. But this time, Sudan is very, very different. Why? Because the war is mainly happening in urban areas. For example, Khartoum remained the epicenter of the conflict, which is a city of, 6 to 8 million people. Used to be, 8 million people used to live there. Almost 2 years, there was nonstop, very serious war going on with all types of weapons being used. So there is definitely a lot of unexploded ordnance with these very limited teams that we have. And those teams are just finding unexploded ordnance everywhere. Like around more than 16,000 of them have been found in a limited period of time. That gives you an idea that how many more unexploded ordnance are laying there. So I was there last week in Khartoum if you look at it, there is no doubt that those areas needs to be cleared first to make it safe. So there are a lot of evidence that are showing the presence of explosive ordnance in minefield. We are finding mines. It was residential areas. And we are trying to, block people, but we will be in a time that blocking people will be difficult, because when return is accelerated, people go to those areas, and tragedies are going to happen. For example, in the Syria program, just in a less than around in 9 months or 10 months time, there were 1,500 people, almost 1,500 people were reported either killed or injured, with 800 explosions that happened. So our Syria program is a little bit organized. They have the reporting system. I'm sure the same is happening here, but we are not getting all the reports. Media is not interested in reflecting those reports because there are many other political news that are focused on. So definitely people are at risk, and they are going to be increasingly at risk. And in relation to the IHL, the use of some of the weapons. Sudan is state parties to the Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention. Unfortunately, Sudan is not state party to the convention on certain conventional weapons, which has provisions of preventing and dealing with the unexploded ordnance. I think I would say Generally, I'm not a legal expert, but generally, IHL, international humanitarian laws, are violated. The weapons, I can say that, which are used in urban areas are not designed for urban areas. They are very indiscriminate. They leave a lot of unexploded ordnance, a lot of destructions. In addition, someone will ask that how long this unexploded ordnance will last. If you look at it and listen to the experts, it's quite concerning, worrying, because these explosive ordnance last very long. Even the explosive ordnance that are left behind in the 60s and 70s in the countries like Vietnam and their surrounding countries there, those UXOs still kill and injure people. So this lasts very long, and if they are not addressed, it will not only affect the current generation, it will be a problem for future generations. It will become a silent killer, and so it's quite serious. I hope I answered some of your questions, not all.
I think yes, indeed, you satisfied the questions, and maybe just colleagues. I on this issue, I should mention that as recent as a couple of days ago, our Secretary General Antonio Guterres, at a press encounter, explicitly talked about the need to stop the flow of weapons and fighters from external parties, noting they must be cut off. So this was from a press encounter we shared with you. Okay, let's take the next question, starting in the room first. No, I see that we have Emma from Reuters. I should also mention that Christian of WHO is connected, and I think maybe after your question, Emma, Christian, if you want to jump in and address human rights, or rather a health angle in Sudan. But let's take your first, the question from Emma first. Go ahead, Emma.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Rashid. Presumably the artillery and rockets and unexploded bombs you're finding don't have made in XXX on the back of them, but can you tell us anything about their origins? And then for UNHCR, please, are people still barricaded inside El Fasher? Have you been able to extrapolate based on the size of the population and the number of displaced people turning up, sort of how many are missing and might still be trapped inside the city? And could you elaborate a bit more on the situation in Kordofan, please? Is displacement happening there? Are people starting to run away? And are you afraid that what happened in Al Fashir in terms of the scale of the displacement is about to happen in Kordofan as well? Thank you.
Thank you, Emma. I'll start off with Mr. Rashid.
Sure. Thank you very much, Emma, for the question. In terms of the unexploded ordnance that we have so far found, I don't think we have looked at, it's coming from which country. Maybe I should be able to answer your question later, but now I don't have that information with me that maybe we have not, our colleagues are not focusing on those things now. So they are so overwhelmed. The teams are tasked here and there. Currently one of our team is working on the Khartoum airport. The UNHAS terminal is under clearance and in the minefield. And we know what type of the mines are there in, I can answer your question later on this after consulting with my colleagues. Over.
Thanks very much. Over to you, Jacqueline, on the other questions. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Emma, for asking the question. I mean, very important question. How many people are still in El Fasher? Actually, we don't know. The most recent sort of estimate I've heard is around 50,000 civilians maybe left in El Fasher. But frankly speaking, you also hear much higher numbers and you also hear lower numbers. What we have seen, though, and that is of concern, is that although the DTM mechanism reports that approximately 90,000 people have left El Fasher, what we have seen so far arriving in Tawila, the main hub, is less than 8,000 people. And what we have seen arriving in Adaba is 2,000 people. Okay, the distance is very long, so it may take more time, and definitely authorities in Adaba expect more new arrivals. But it still looks like, you know, there are a significant number of people remaining in Al-Fashir, and a significant number of people that are on the move, stranded somewhere, not able to move further because of the danger, or because they risk being sent back into Al-Fashir, or because there are very vulnerable people amongst the group, such as persons with disability, as Sadiq also referred to. We don't know. The situation in Kordofan is also very tense, and we are monitoring this carefully together with, of course, OCHA and other colleagues. Yes, we are concerned that in Kordofan also the further escalation of the conflict may also lead to further displacement. So together with colleagues from OCHA, we are drafting currently a response plan. We have seen already a large number of people leaving Bara town, which is not far from Al Obeid. We hear similar concerning stories about huge violations of human rights in IHL. And what we are also really worried about is the road between Al Obeid and Kosti, which is sort of the only safe way out now. But due to the conflict, due to fighting, we're very worried that also Al Obeid eventually may be in a besieged-like situation where it will be very difficult for people to move out, and further impossible for people to deliver humanitarian aid. So I think I've responded to your questions.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Jacqueline. Emma, I think you have a follow-up.
Just quickly, yeah. So on Al-Fashir, you're talking about then tens of thousands of people unaccounted for, really. Is that right?
That is, if we look at the estimations, but again, you know, we are not able to certify this with precision as we are looking at, you know, the people that are stranded. We think, given, you know, the data of people that have left Al-Fashir, which are approximately 90,000 people. But then in terms of arrivals to other locations, we don't see that number reflected. So they are stranded somewhere. And one of the locations where people were stranded, where there is now a limited humanitarian access, is a place called Korma. And we know that about 10,000 people are stranded there, waiting for transport or for other support to move to Tawila. I hope that explains. Thank you.
Yes, it does. It's a very difficult situation indeed. Okay, let's maybe, before we take further questions, let's maybe first hear from Christian of WHO, who wanted to chime in on the health aspects of the crisis. Go ahead, Christian.
Thank you very much, Rolando, and thanks, Jacqueline from UNHCR, to raise the topic and to come up with the health situation, because to remind you again, people are dying from a lack of access to basic essential healthcare and medication. As per our latest emergency reports in that direction, only 48%, so less than half of the health facilities across all of Sudan's 18 states are fully functioning, and 12% of the facilities are partially functional, and 40 are non-functional. So nearly half not accessible. And Sudan is one of the world's largest food crises, with over 21 million people facing high levels of acute food insecurity as of September this year. And the famine, as you know, was confirmed in El-Fasher and Galuli town on 20 areas across Greater Darfur and Greater Kordofan area are at risk of famine. And famine and malnutrition especially always brings with it disease outbreaks and infections. So just some of the highest numbers right now. The reports of cholera, dengue, malaria, and measles are being received from several states. Cholera, we have about you have already reports about over 120,000 cases and about 3,500 associated deaths. That's reported from 151 localities in all Sudan's 18 states by 1 November, just very recent. That is a case fatality of 3%, nearly 3%, which is triple the WHO threshold of 1%. Dengue, nearly 45,000 cases and 115 associated deaths also reported from nearly 70 localities in 13 out of the 18 states, and that's also from 1 September. So that just hints of a complete breakdown of the wash system, the water, the sanitation, hygiene, and especially with people fleeing from one corner to the other, being cramped together in camps or in housings, that just exacerbates the situation and the risk for any disease outbreaks.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Christian, and thanks in advance for sharing these vital statistics with us. Very important angle, of course. Further questions on Sudan, colleagues? Looking at you in the room, online. I don't have anything further to add? No. So on that note, I'd like to thank you very much, Sadiq, Jacqueline, and Christian as well. Good luck with this immensely important work you're doing in country. And of course, feel free to jump in on this at this briefing at any point in time. Thank you very much once again. Thank you, Eugene. Okay, Tamin, from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, we're going to hear about the situation now in the occupied West Bank as Tamin makes his way up here. And then we still have on the agenda, to remind you, Ukraine and an update on Hurricane Melissa, as well as an update. So when you're settled in, and maybe while you're settling in, maybe while I... if you allow me just to highlight something we shared with you, I believe it was last night. It was a statement from Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini of UNRWA, as you well know, to the Fourth Committee at the General Assembly. He highlighted many important aspects of the work of his agency. In the statement that we shared with you, he basically told the GA that safeguarding UNRWA's mandate and operations is vital to the survival of millions of Palestinians, essential for a much-needed solution. Specifically on the West Bank, which we'll just hear from Tamim about, he noted that in the occupied West Bank, the loss of the agency's services to nearly a million Palestinian refugees would intensify the immense pressure on the Palestinian authorities. It would exacerbate a volatile situation in which more than 30,000 Palestinians have been displaced by Israeli security operations, and settler violence is at unprecedented levels. So this is an excerpt from Mr. Lazzarini's statement delivered yesterday to the GA. Now I'll throw over to you, Tamin. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. Images of mobs of masked Israeli settlers carrying out arson attacks in the occupied West Bank this week are abhorrent and reflect a wider pattern of increased violence against Palestinians. Several people were injured in the attacks, which included a raid on a dairy factory and the torching of delivery trucks and homes. The surge in violence comes as Israeli authorities have ramped up home demolitions, the seizure of property, arrests, and movement restrictions, alongside the unabated building of settlements and outposts, and the forcible displacement and transfer of thousands of Palestinians by Israeli settlers and the military. Permanently displacing the Palestinian population within occupied territory amounts to unlawful transfer, which is a war crime. The transfer by Israel of parts of its own civilian population into territory it occupies also amounts to a war crime. We reiterate that the Israeli government's assertion of sovereignty over the occupied West Bank and its annexation of parts of it are in breach of international law, as the International Court of Justice has confirmed. They also violate the Palestinian people's right to self-determination. More settler attacks were recorded in October than in any month since 2006, and that is over 260 attacks. Since the 7th of October 2023 and up until the 13th of November 2025, Israeli security forces and settlers have killed at least 1,017 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Among the victims were 221 children. This does not include Palestinians who have died in Israeli detention. During the same period, 59 Israelis were killed in Palestinian attacks or alleged attacks or armed clashes. Among the latest fatalities in the West Bank was a 13-year-old boy, Palestinian boy, Aysam Jihad Labib Nasser. He died on Tuesday, a month after inhaling tear gas fired by Israeli security forces towards him and his family as settlers attacked them while they were trying to harvest olives in their land in Beita, near Nablus. Just last week, on the 6th of November, two 16-year-old boys, Palestinian boys, Muhammad Abdullah Muhammad Taim and Muhammad Rashid Fadl Qasim, were shot and killed by Israeli forces in Al-Judaira village in East Jerusalem. The Israeli authorities allege that they were throwing Molotov cocktails. 2 days later, a 26-year-old Palestinian man was killed in a raid on Al-Far'a refugee camp west of Tubas. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk reiterates that attacks against Palestinians and the property must stop, and those responsible must be held to account. Israel must end its unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territory, including by ceasing immediately all new settlement activities and evacuating all settlers from the occupied Palestinian territory. Palestinians' right to self-determination must be realized. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tamin. Okay, let's take questions in the room first for Tamin, if any. No, and I think, I believe, Gabby, that was a mistake of mine. I think your question might still be for Mr. Rashid, but let's first see if we have questions for Tamin. Let's take, Gabby, is this indeed on Sudan? And it's, again, my apologies.
It's on Gaza.
Okay, very good.
Well.
Okay, over to you then, Gabby.
Yes, thank you so much. My question is if sending Molotov's bombs are a cause to kill someone, because, I mean, maybe you can detain those boys or something, but killing them, can you talk about this, please? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gabriella. So I imagine the question was on the West Bank, not on Gaza. If it's in reference to the boys that I mentioned,
yes,
in the statement, yeah.
Sorry.
Basically, the law that applies in the West Bank, we're talking about a situation of law enforcement. So it's international human rights law that applies. And security forces must not use lethal force unless there is a danger for their an imminent danger or imminent threat to their lives. So basically, any use of lethal force must be done with that condition, and security forces must do all they can in order to avoid the use of lethal force against against anyone in the context of the law enforcement in the West Bank. Of course, we are talking about children as well, and as you can imagine, Israeli security forces are more heavily armed than two boys who would have Molotov cocktails. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Gabby, is this a follow-up on OPT?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Just a clarification. So Israelis, again, violating the human rights law. This can go to an international court or something like that. Is that correct? Thank you so much.
Of course, we are calling for accountability here for all the actions that are being taken by Israeli security forces and by Israeli settlers against the Palestinians in the West Bank. So, of course, there have to be investigations, and there must be accountability. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, Alicia. Efe.
Yes, Aliza from the Spanish News Agency. I wanted to ask if there is some kind of recognition from the Israeli authorities of these attacks, of these increasing attacks, or they are hiding them, or how they are talking about them.
Thank you for that, Alicia. We are not seeing enough investigations, enough serious investigations in these attacks. There is impunity that is prevailing in this situation. For example, when it comes to the attacks that I mentioned, the arson attacks by different groups of settlers in the West Bank, we know that the Israeli forces reportedly arrested 4 Israeli settlers in connection to the attacks and handed them over to the police, but only 1 remained in custody. We are yet to see genuine accountability. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Moussa.
Merci beaucoup. Il y a 3 jours, il y avait une équipe israélienne durant la discussion de comité de droits de l'homme contre la torture dans l'immeuble de la commission de droits de l'homme. L'équipe israélienne a insisté comme quoi les Palestiniens de la Cisjordanie, ils ont été traités le plus humain possible, et en prison ils avaient annoncé que les prisonniers, ils ont des services de santé toujours, et il y a de repas chauds 3 fois par jour et service médical, et il n'y a pas de torture dans les prisons israéliennes. Est-ce que cette image convient le rapport des Nations Unies et vos rapports à vous? Merci.
Merci Moussa. En effet, par rapport à cette session que vous avez mentionnée, il est important de poser aussi la question aux experts du comité. Mais ce que je peux vous dire là-dessus, c'est que nous avons déjà alerté plusieurs fois, y compris dans un rapport détaillé l'année dernière, sur les conditions de détention dans les prisons israéliennes pour les détenus palestiniens. On parle de conditions très, très difficiles, y compris de la torture, des traitements inhumains. Nous avons des cas de violences sexuelles. Donc tout cela est très inquiétant, et il faut que les autorités israéliennes mènent de vraies enquêtes pour rétablir les responsabilités et traduire ceux qui sont responsables en justice. Merci.
Merci, Tamin. Okay, we take a question online from Imen, Kuwait News Agency. Imen.
Thank you so much. I have actually 2 questions. The first one about the report of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights regarding the report of regarding actually testimony of systematic rape and sexual torture against Palestinian hostages in the Israeli prison. Are you thinking to open an investigation into this finding of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights? And the second one is for Femin and Ricardo, if he's connected from UNICEF, about this law approved by the Israeli Knesset permitting the execution of the Palestinian detainees, including children. Do you have any comment on that? Thank you so much.
Thank you for that, Iman. So as I have said, the conditions of detention in Israeli prisons for Palestinian detainees are very difficult. They are horrible, and we have alerted on that on multiple occasions, including in a very detailed report last year that talked about the cases of torture, inhumane treatment, and even cases of sexual violence against Palestinian detainees. We reiterate our call for accountability for all these actions. There must be investigations, and those responsible must be held to account. Of course, any such practices must cease immediately as well, and all Palestinians arbitrarily detained must be released immediately and unconditionally. On the draft law that you mentioned, our position on death penalty in general is very clear, is that we are against death penalty anywhere and everywhere. In the context of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territory, and what I have just mentioned in terms of the conditions of detention for Palestinian detainees and the lack of due process and fair trial guarantees, this is even more concerning. So it is clear for us that this draft law must not go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Very clear. Thanks so much, Tamin. Further questions? No. In the room, make sure I don't miss any online. No, that's not the case. So thank you so very much, Tamin, as always, for joining us here on this very important story. Okay, shifting to Ukraine. Tommaso of the IFRC is with us. He's going to introduce a guest who's joining us from Kyiv. Thank you, Tommaso.
Good morning, all. So today we'll have with us our IFRC operations manager in Ukraine, Viktor Niambala, speaking from Kyiv. Our original plan, and of course we'll follow up on this, was to brief on the winter preparations effort in Ukraine, but Viktor will also update you on the brutal attacks that happened last night in Ukraine. So Viktor, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tommaso, and greetings from Kyiv to my distinguished colleagues. After what was another brutal night in Ukraine, there was another large-scale attack across the country with more than 400 drones and missiles launched at Ukraine. In Kyiv, the attacks targeted critical infrastructure. Fires were ignited, and I heard the explosions throughout the night. Sadly, people are still being injured, and more families are actually losing loved ones. This morning, I talked to some of my colleagues who don't have cooking gas, their central heating is down, and electricity in their homes is actually non-existent because we have power cuts after power stations have been hit. And we can only hope that water will not be cut off. Now, in the first 7 months of this year, there have been more than 1,200 attacks on energy infrastructure. And this is almost as many as in all of 2024, according to official figures. Damage to the network is widespread, and reconstruction efforts cannot keep up with the speed and the scale of destruction. For many people in Ukraine, winter has become a race for survival, a season when families count the time not until the holidays, rather until the next power cut. They wonder not about what gifts to buy or family and friends, but how they will be able to afford the next meal. Already last winter, 60% of people we surveyed, they said that they did not have enough food, and 50% did not have stable access to water, electricity, and gas. This winter may even be harder. Power cuts can leave entire cities in the dark for up to 12 hours a day. When I walk around, I hear generators buzzing. Not all small and medium enterprises can afford to buy generators. businesses are collapsing. This means no lights and no heating at home, no cooking dinner, and even children cannot do their homework. Think about the older people who live in high-rise buildings and apartments. They use elevators to move around, but when the lights are out, they become trapped in their apartments. Now, these blackouts are affecting many aspects of daily lives. Shops in particular and restaurants cannot refrigerate their foodstuffs, and that means that they incur huge losses. Farmers are unable to store and process simple products such as milk, which they produce. Bakeries keep their doors shut because the ovens cannot work. And that means that prices continue to rise with increasing demand, as well as inflation. We are seeing the businesses close day by day. And that also means that people are left without jobs or basic livelihoods. The past 4 years have eroded people's resources. Many families are entering this winter with almost no financial buffer, and 7 in 10 people, which is approximately 70%, have reported that they don't have any savings left. There is no safety net to fall back on, and certainly no margin to cushion another shock. In the past 4 years, IFRC and the Ukrainian Red Cross, as well as partners in the country, have worked side by side to meet humanitarian needs. This year, we aim to support around 500,000 people through our winterization plan to help families stay warm and safe, to strengthen their resilience. Our teams are working to restore access to heating, clean water, and energy, especially in the most affected areas. We are distributing a variety of relief items, including energy systems, power backup equipment, and even rechargeable lighting kits, just to help during the blackouts. We're providing cash assistance to vulnerable people so they can cover their essential needs. And these basic needs include heating and also fuel. We give small grants to rural households to rebuild their livelihoods so they can build their local capacity to respond to emergencies within their communities, to ensure they're resilient and better prepared for the cold months ahead. We've been providing support to people since the escalation of the conflict, but it's not enough. The scale of the needs is overwhelming, and with each passing day, those needs are growing. At this critical moment, we call on governments and donors to urgently invest in emergency response, as well as the long-term recovery of Ukraine. People should not have to choose between whether to eat food, heat their homes, or treat their illnesses. Let's make sure that no one is left behind, not in the dark and not in the cold. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Victor. Colleagues, over to you. Yes, Alicia of the Spanish News Agency.
I wanted to ask if you could tell us how many power cuts are in a day or in a week, and also if Ukrainians are facing more difficulties in winter each year because they have less savings, or what are the tendencies you're seeing in this sense? Thank you.
Thank you for that question. And I think I'll speak personally. Where I stay, I have power cuts for 8 hours a day and lights for 4 hours a day. And that's in the capital city. So I can imagine how bad it is in the outskirts, in the rural areas. And in regards to the complexities, I think we have some compounding aspects when you look at not just the hits against the infrastructure, but also economically. When you have businesses not able to run, industries because of lack of electricity, that means that the economy is actually collapsing day by day. Livelihoods are getting destroyed. People are losing their jobs. We can see the pressure of inflation. And in general, as winter comes and the temperatures drop, we also see a rise in terms of acute illnesses, such as respiratory illnesses. So the issues are very compounding, and very much interrelated. And this is why we see people making tough decisions between should they eat or should they heat their homes, or are they going to treat their illnesses?
Thank you very much, Victor, for the questions. Colleagues in the room, online? No, I don't see that's the case. So, Victor, thank you once again. And Tommaso, of course, another very important story and development. Do keep us informed. And again, feel free to join us at any point in time. Thank you, Victor.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Two more items. We'll now shift to the Caribbean. Hurricane Melissa, we have an update from a colleague from UNDP. Sarah, I think maybe you want to introduce your colleague. Sarah Bell from UNDP is online, and we have a colleague joining us from Jamaica. Go ahead, Sarah.
Thanks, Rolando. And I think my colleague is not online. Can you confirm? I think he had some connectivity issue.
Oh, I didn't. Okay, can we? Yes, I'm getting the signal from the booth that he's not connected, Mr. Jackson. Well,
okay.
Go ahead, please.
Let me give very quickly the top line of what he wanted to share. And if there is any follow-up question and interest, I'll connect the journalist directly with him and I'll send the detailed talking points. But basically, we've got new data on the damage, and the government unit for geospatial data management has just completed a large-scale satellite-based assessment. And there is about almost 1 million buildings that were assessed. And among these, it's about 10% that are totally destroyed or really highly severely damaged. I'll share all the details. And also we're working with drone image acquisition and analysis to validate and refine this finding. Regarding new satellite analysis that we've just conducted, we can estimate that there is about over 4.8 million tons of debris across Western Jamaica. This is the equivalent to nearly 480,000 standard truckloads of debris. And this is a mix of building debris, vegetation, and personal property debris. Obviously, this data will inform the recovery plan. But I can also say that there's a preliminary conservative government estimate about the cost of the reconstruction, and the preliminary estimate suggests that it's about $6 and $7 billion in damage, around 28 to 32% of Jamaica GDP. So the next phase is going to focus on debris clearance and recovery planning, as I mentioned. It has to focus also on SMEs and livelihood stabilization, solar energy for critical community services. And yes, we're working with all the parties involved in what we call risk-informed rebuilding. That's all for me. And again, my apologies for our colleagues, Ron Jackson, who is the team lead disaster risk reduction and recovery for UNDP, who is on site at the moment in Jamaica. And unfortunately, I think he had some connective issue. But happy to connect the dots, send you the briefing points and connect you with Ron whenever possible. Over.
Thanks so much, Sarah. It's really important to keep the spotlight on the recovery plans to this catastrophe, which has affected many countries. And do thank Mr. Jackson for trying to connect. I realize it's also very early in the morning for him in Jamaica, but thank you very much for that brief. And if you can share those notes, that would be appreciated. Do we have any questions for the moment on this subject? No, that's not the case. So again, I think we'll reach out to you, Sarah, should there be questions afterwards. Thank you again. Okay, last but not least, Thomas of the UNEC, and thank you for your patience, has an announcement for us on the Aarhus Convention.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. So next week here in the Palais, UNECE will bring together some 300 representatives of governments, civil society, international organizations, and other stakeholders to discuss achievements and remaining challenges in the area of human rights and the environment. Now, this takes the form of the 8th session of the meeting of the parties to the Convention on Access to Information, Public Participation, and Decision-Making, and Access to Justice in Environmental Matters. Now, that's a long title. It's more frequently known as the Aarhus Convention. And simultaneously, later that week, in fact, the 5th session of the meeting of the parties to the Protocol on Pollutant Releases and Transfer Registers, known as the Protocol on PRTRs. Now, this is every 4 years, the highest decision-making bodies under these treaties, and I'll explain to you what they do. Now, this is in Tempus from 17 to 21 November, so all of next week. So these UNECE treaties are open for accession by all member states of the United Nations, and they provide legally binding frameworks to advance transparency and environmental democracy, including regarding climate change. And COP30 is going on right now. Well, these are the type of instruments that facilitate the public's role in the decision-making process. Now, the Aarhus Convention is actively used by individuals and NGOs working on environmental matters to put the rights to information, participation, and justice into action for 48 parties. Now, those are the EU and the majority of the UNECE member states in the pan-European region, plus Guinea-Bissau, which became the first party outside the region in 2023. On 20th of November, a joint high-level segment of the two bodies is expected to adopt the Geneva Declaration on Advancing Public Rights to Tackle the Triple Planetary Crisis in the Face of Geopolitical Tensions. Now, the parties are expected to set priorities for 2026-29. So this is every 4 years. They're setting the work for the next years. The decisions to be taken include on compliance with countries' obligations under these treaties, under the Aarhus Convention in particular. And those aim to assist individual parties to improve their legislation and practice and bring themselves into compliance in areas such as oil and gas extraction, gold and lithium mining, nuclear power plants, and renewable energy. One of the key milestones that will be marked is the entry into force of the GMO amendment, which we announced here some months ago, earlier this year, and which essentially improves transparency on everything to do with GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and welcoming as well the accession of Uzbekistan as the latest party to the convention. Importantly for you, as you've been following his work, some of you quite closely, the meeting of the parties will mark the completion of the first term of the Special Rapporteur on Environmental Defenders under the Aarhus Convention, Michel Forst. They will consider a decision on the scope and renewal of his mandate. And as you know, he has been very active in putting pressure on governments to protect environmental defenders who in many countries have been under subject to harassment, penalization, criminalization, persecution. One final note that the protocol on pollutant release and transfer registers is expected to adopt a decision that will help countries to modernize these registers, which are essentially databases of pollution and greenhouse gas emissions, so improving transparency again. That's all for us, but we remain available, as always, to facilitate contact with delegations, to help you follow the cases that you might be interested in if you're following particular countries, and to put you in contact with experts to the extent possible. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Thomas. Very important announcement indeed. Questions for Thomas? Yes, Body.
Hi, Thomas. You mentioned 20th November, you will have the high level segment to adopt some declarations. Is that included all the country members of the United States or only your members with some observers? And you also mentioned the meeting of the parties. The meeting of the parties, what that means the parties who are adopt several important decisions. The party is the participating or all the member states of the United States, United Nations. Thank you.
Thank you. Good question indeed. Now, this is the meeting of the parties, which means that all of the countries that have ratified this particular treaty, well, there are two next week, but speaking of the Aarhus Convention, 48 parties, all of those which have ratified. So the ones that participate are those that have ratified. The ones which decide are those which have ratified. So every 4 years with a treaty like this, it's when the members of the treaty, the signatories to that treaty, come together to decide and take the most important decisions. This declaration I referred to will be discussed and is expected to be adopted by the parties to this treaty. Now, UNECE has 56 member states. The Aarhus Convention has 48 parties, so slightly less, but we're talking about the countries that have ratified this treaty. One clarification. One clarification is that these treaties are open to accession by all UN member states, so worldwide. For the moment, there is one country that has ratified the Aarhus Convention outside the pan-European region, Guinea-Bissau. I would just comment on that this treaty and its success in Europe over several decades led to the adoption, negotiation and adoption of the Escazú Agreement in Latin America and the Caribbean, which you may have heard about. So there's global interest in this work, but this is reserved for the parties, the countries that have ratified this instrument.
Thanks very much for that, Thomas. Further questions for Thomas? No, that's not the case. So thank you very much, and good luck with this meeting coming up next week. Just a few announcements before we wrap up. As you well know, colleagues, the Human Rights Council is engaged in a special session on the situation, human rights situation in Sudan. I'm not sure where they stand right now, but they are scheduled to wrap up around 1 o'clock with action on a draft resolution, which you have before you, after having heard from a long list of speakers who have addressed very much the situations that we just heard about, a few UNHCR colleagues, as well as our unmasked colleague. So do keep an eye on those proceedings. On Sudan also, and more broadly the continent, I just wanted to share with you the joint communique that of the 9th African Union United Nations Annual Conference readout that we shared with you last night with the Secretary General addressed earlier this week. In this communique, there are various situations that are highlighted, including the situation in the Sahel, in Mali, Madagascar, and South Sudan, and Sudan, of course, as well as other states. So that's a communique we shared with you. In terms of meetings here, in addition to the special session, we have the Committee Against Torture, which is still underway. This coming Tuesday, the committee will review Bahrain. And then starting next week, we have the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, otherwise known as CERD. It's 116th session starting on Monday, the 17th, during which it will review the following states: the Maldives, Guatemala, Sweden, Burundi, New Zealand, and Tunisia. So do take a look at that media advisory. And this afternoon, after the special session, the Council's UPR, Universal Periodic Review, working group will conclude its session after having adopted the reports for the remaining countries for Belarus, Liberia, Malawi, Mongolia, Panama, Maldives, Andorra, Bulgaria, Honduras, the Marshall Islands, Croatia, Jamaica, and Libya, if you caught all that. So that's a lot to adopt this afternoon. And two last points, just to mention that this coming Sunday is the World Day of Remembrance for Road Traffic Victims. The 16th of November is the day. And among other things in the ESG's message, he notes that every year 1.2 million people are killed in road crashes, and another 50 million are left injured or disabled. He also notes that to date, the UN Road Safety Conventions, the Road Safety Fund, and the Special Envoy for Road Safety have helped 94 countries save lives on the road. Important message indeed. And last but certainly not least, as Alessandra mentioned earlier this week, we have coming up next week a very nice event, the Young Activist Summit. It's an annual event here. The 7th Young Activist Summit, otherwise known as the YAS, will convene on Thursday the 20th at 10 a.m. We'll hear from five outstanding young individuals between age 17 and 27 who will be presenting the important work they've done in their countries, Côte d'Ivoire, India, Lebanon, Brazil, and Japan, to drive positive change by using technology. So we've shared with you the press release and the program, truly an important event that we are very proud to host here at the UN office at Geneva. So that's it from me. If you have any questions, nope. In that case, I wish you a good afternoon and see you on Tuesday.